Before introducing the next speaker, I have several announcements. First,
thank you, Professor Meiselman, Professor Banfield, Professor Wiggins. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the more engaging of the urban prospects, I think, for the 1970s, which is the main topic of our afternoon session, is the possibility of rather significant growth in the non-public sector of education. I hasten to say that that growth is anything but assured in view of the fact that most private institutions are now faced with very serious financial problems, and in view of the fact that they will continue to be faced with the further problem of opposition to any really significant growth on their part, opposition from, well, what I might call the public education establishment, which has in the past, and I'm sure will continue in the future, to be, shall we say, unenthusiastic about the multiplication of private schools at any level of the system, or any other kind of development in the private sector that seems to threaten to diminish their own power or their own tax support. But nevertheless, I think there are significant and optimistic signs for the 1970s, and I'd like to mention in the few minutes that I have with you this afternoon what some of them are. I may add that just in passing, my own private conviction that a tremendous growth in the options and alternatives in the educational system, by that I mean all kinds of private schools, independent schools, non-public institutions of great variety, I think that kind of growth in the 70s would be the best thing that could happen to the public sector of education as well as to everybody else that's involved. But first, let me just take a moment so that we all begin in the same place, to review where we are in the public-private educational problem, the present situation. Only about 13% of all the young people, children and young people who are enrolled in elementary and secondary schools in the country are enrolled in private establishments. And most of those, of course, are Catholic parochial schools. Now, one might suppose, therefore, that since 87% of all the children in the country are enrolled in public institutions, that there really isn't much of a movement toward private, the non-public sector in education. But I think there are those factors that I would like to mention. And looking from the elementary and secondary level for a moment to higher education, we've seen, of course, a drift away from the private sector for a good many years, and that drift now is accelerating, as all of you know who happen to be connected in some way with private institutions. Of all the young people now enrolled in colleges and universities, there can't be more now, I think, than 30% that are enrolled in non-public institutions. So the private institutions, as they're now constituted anyway, at all levels of the educational system, are confronted with some pretty serious problems. A number of Catholic schools, as we know, have closed in recent years, and the church is talking about closing a great many more, which would have disastrous consequences in many communities on the local tax rate, and which would have the further consequence, of course, of abolishing one important option and alternative in the educational system. As for the non-sectarian element of the educational system, that is the private independent schools, as they're usually called, these have never bulked very large in our educational system, and they are naturally caught in the same ravages of inflation and skyrocketing costs as are the Catholic schools. And they have another problem, pretty much of their own making in this case, and that is their failure to offer a real contrast instead of merely a complement to the public education system. If we look, for example, at the 750 institutions or thereabouts that make up the National Association of Independent Schools, these schools enroll about 230,000 young people now, we see that many of them suffer from the same problems as public schools. Inertia, poorly qualified staff, low standards, a lack of imaginative and innovative programs of various kinds. And so, although this is not true, obviously, of all 750 institutions, it's true of far too many schools of a group that we might think of as constituting some kind of elite group of schools. So that's one reason for their problems. Their failure to offer, in short, a genuine option instead of simply a more expensive choice. And the same is true of higher education, I believe. The private colleges and universities, certainly those below the first rank, in a desperate effort to compete with the public institutions now, wind up pretty much imitating the public institutions. And when the financial weather gets rough enough, of course, they make hurriedly for the shelter of the public sector. That is, they go public. Instead of conducting, in other words, a searching examination of their own programs and procedures, instead of making a serious effort to reduce the waste and inefficiency that is characteristic, I think, of all our institutions of higher education, they take the easiest escape. Any of you that are familiar with the economics of institutions such as the University of Pittsburgh, or the University of Buffalo, the University of Kansas City, or others that have gone public in recent years, I think will recognize that they took, in the face of intractable financial problems, they took the easiest way out. Instead of undertaking a really thoroughgoing internal reconstruction, they simply went public. But at the same time, I have to admit that when a college or university does come along that does seem to offer some innovative programs, particularly if it is trying to make some new paths through the jungle of educational economics, the educational establishment can give it a pretty hard time. Those of you that are familiar with the, even in a general way, with the history of Parsons College in Iowa during the 1960s, will know what I'm talking about. That experiment culminated in 1967 in the disaccreditation of Parsons by the North Central Association here in Chicago. Incidentally, that accreditation was just reestablished, I think, last week. Parsons, unfortunately, went about many of its activities in a somewhat exhibitionistic way and asked for many of the problems that it encountered. It was a source of tremendous bitterness and embarrassment to many other college presidents in the area, and they wanted to see Parsons fail, and they let their wishes be known, in no uncertain terms, to the North Central Association. Well, it's a long story and a fascinating one, and if I can be allowed to put in a commercial, there is a book coming out on that in June called The Parsons College Bubble. So even when an institution like that does come along with some ideas, it gets trampled on pretty hurriedly by the educational establishment if it doesn't conduct itself very circumspectly. So from the point of view of existing institutions and existing procedures and programs and methods, the prospects for non-public education in the 1970s wouldn't seem to be too good. But there are, as I indicated, some happier signs and portents on the horizon. Let me just tick off a few of them. I think they're more than straws in the wind. Let's for the moment call them weather vanes. Number one, I think there is a greater willingness now on the part of many people in education to recognize the failures of the public educational system and to recognize that the cure for these failures is not necessarily more public education. And I would include in this group of people, a good many people in the United States Office of Education, in some of the State Departments of Education, and in some of the professional associations where there's a great deal of talk now about something called accountability. By accountability, they mean, of course, the willingness on the part of professional educators and their organizations to accept responsibility for results and for failures and for their obligation to find remedies for the failures. Now, for example, there is, I think, a general acknowledgement within the educational community of the tragic failure of the American public school, particularly in urban areas, to teach very large numbers of children to read in the early elementary grades. And since they cannot read, they can't do anything else in the educational system. Now, a lot of people have been crying in the wilderness about that failure for the better part of 20 years. And now, last year, happily, those people got a considerable boost from the U.S. Commissioner of Education, Jim Allen, when he launched a nationwide Right to Read campaign. Although there are a lot of educators, orthodox educators, who are still saying the problem with reading is simply that we need more money, we need more teachers of reading, we need more of this, we need more public education, in short. But there are others, in significant numbers, who are beginning to look elsewhere than the usual public school in the usual inner city area to see if they can find an answer to this problem. Some of them are beginning, in other words, I think, to feel a little like that famous comic strip character Pogo, who in one of his more immortal lines said, "We have met the enemy, and they is us." I think some educators are beginning to feel that way. Now, for example, the United States Office of Education last year gave a $250,000 grant to the school system, the public school system of Texarkana, to finance a 5-year experimental program to see if private industry, if private enterprise, would be able to do a better job of teaching dropout kids, or what educators in their characteristic jargon like to call low achievers, if they could do a better job than the public schools. This contract was put out for bids, and the bidding was pretty competitive. It was pretty hot, with major corporations in the picture: IBM, McGraw-Hill, Westinghouse, quite a few others. The contract finally went to a little-known organization called Dorset Educational Services from Norman, Oklahoma. And without troubling you with the details, the gist of this contractual relationship between Dorset and the local school board is that they agree that payment under this contract will be made only on the basis of measured results within a stipulated time. That there will be payment if these students are brought to a certain level of performance within a certain time, and payment enough to allow for a reasonable profit. And if Dorset fails to perform in this fashion, there will in fact be a penalty for Dorset. To be specific, on just the question of reading, more than reading is involved, other subjects are too. But in reading, the stipulated agreement is that the students will, their reading level will rise one grade level for every 80 hours of instruction. And if it does, Dorset will get $80 for that student. If the student progresses faster, better than that, Dorset will get a bonus of $27 per student. If, however, the student progresses less well than that, falls below the stipulated figure, Dorset will forfeit $27. Well, a lot of educators, of course, looked with shock and dismay on the whole experiment, considering it a shameless dehumanization of the educational process and the children involved. The same educators rarely asked themselves, however, why the kids dropped out in the first place, and that might not have something to do with the dehumanization in the public school. But in any case, the early results, and it is too early to make any definitive statements about this, but the early results from the Texarkana experiment are really quite encouraging. If that experiment does in fact succeed in the long run, I think we may see many other such contractual relationships between school boards, public education authorities, and private enterprise. Now, this is not necessarily, and it's not exactly an alternative to the public education system, but certainly it represents a new kind of partnership which diminishes the monopolistic control of the educational system by public authorities. And I think we see similar kinds of contractual relationships now taking place in other areas of the educational system where failure has finally been recognized on a widespread basis by educators themselves. If we look, for example, at the whole field of vocational education, which has, at least in many of its aspects, been a dismal failure for a great many years. The Job Corps, for example, whatever you may think of it ideologically, was an unprecedented effort on the part of the federal government to see if private enterprise could do something to retrieve young people, students who had been lost by the public education system, and a great many other programs of that type over the last 4 or 5 years have also been going forward. The Manpower Training and Development Act of 1962 and the amendments after it, which are jointly administered by the Department of Labor and the Office of Education, has resulted in a great many contractual relationships between states, state departments of education and other state authorities, and private schools, most of them post-secondary schools, some of them not, however, including technical and so-called proprietary schools. And it turns out that many of these proprietary technical vocational schools in such fields as cosmetology or mechanics or in paramedical specialties do a better job, maintain a higher standard of performance, and do it at a cheaper price than public institutions. So again, although this is not exactly an alternative to public education, it is a new kind of partnership that does help to diminish the monopolistic control of the educational system by public authorities. Well, there's still a third element in this picture in the 1970s that I'd like to mention. That is the concern that many agencies of government, as well as many lay agencies, are now showing for the plight of the private schools and the Catholic schools in particular. I think there's something like 23 states that now have substantial aid to Catholic schools and other private institutions, and many other states that are seriously considering writing this into their state laws. Now, this represents a considerable change of attitude on the part of a great part of the body politic over the last 5 or 10 years. It's now highly respectable to advocate government aid to Catholic, parochial, and other kinds of private schools. And only last month, President Nixon reactivated a body called the National Advisory Council on the Education of Disadvantaged Children, which is headed by Neil McElroy, and gave it a mandate for a 2-year study of educational financing. In doing so, he said that one of the things he hoped this body would do would be to search, I'm quoting him, for ways and means by which non-public schools can be assisted. Our purpose, said President Nixon, is not to aid religion in particular, but to promote diversity in education, end quote. So in the 1970s, if this movement does go forward, we may indeed find that the line between private and public schools begins to be blurred in the same way that it is in England and in the Netherlands, where schools that are essentially private relinquish a certain degree of their authority to the government in exchange for regular financial aid from the government. Well, I'm only halfway through with my remarks, but let me push on to just one or two other things, and then I promise to quit. I can't pass the opportunity of pointing to one final optimistic sign for alternatives, the creation of alternatives in education in the 1970s, and that is the growing acceptance of the profit motive in educational enterprise. I don't mean just the knowledge industry, so-called giant corporations, the so-called learning industry, which has yet to turn much of a profit, as a matter of fact. But I'm thinking of schools that are organized and run and recognized for profit. There's the growth, for example, of franchised schools, particularly elementary schools, by a number of groups around the country, and this is a growing movement, I think. And there is the potentially powerful development seen in the lawsuit of Marjorie Webster Junior College against the Middle States Association of Colleges and Secondary Schools. It was a fascinating lawsuit case, which I will take just a few seconds to brief you on, because I do think it is significant for the 70s. Marjorie Webster Junior College is a proprietary, that is a profit-making school in the District of Columbia, which has had a half century of successful experience. but has never been visited, evaluated, or accredited by its regional accrediting organization called the Middle States Association, simply because the policy of Middle States, not its bylaws or its articles of incorporation, but its policy, restricts membership of that group, as do all of the other five regionals around the country, to nonprofit institutions. And because accreditation now is more important than it has ever been before, Marjorie Webster found that it had no other choice than to take Middle States to court when it could not get any relief from Middle States. Middle States consistently refused to visit or accredit or evaluate the institution because it was a profit-making enterprise. So after years of this kind of frustrating relationship, they did bring suit in 1966 on two major grounds. First, the college, in an unprecedented application of the antitrust laws to American education, charged that Middle States in particular, and Middle States in combination with the other five regionals around the country, were both monopolies in restraint of trade within the meaning of the Sherman Act. And second, the college charged that Middle States and the other five regionals were, in effect, quasi-government agencies, performing functions that were inherently governmental, that were reserved to government in most other countries, and they were doing this at the specific request of various government agencies, such as the Office of Education, and that they were, therefore, subject to the restraints of the Constitution, including due process and the avoidance of arbitrary and discriminatory acts, such as excluding from membership a whole class of institutions without even a hearing. Well, it was a long trial. One of the most eloquent witnesses for the plaintiff, I can't help adding, was one Milton Friedman. A great many witnesses testified, and at the end, the trial court found solidly in favor of the college. It upheld Marjorie Webster on every major count in the case, decided that it agreed that the Middle States Association was, in fact, a monopoly in unreasonable restraint of trade, Marjorie Webster's trade in particular, decided the regionals were indeed quasi-government agencies and bound by the constraints of the Constitution, and it decided that the exclusion of proprietary schools was, in fact, arbitrary and discriminatory, and it ordered Middle States to visit and evaluate Marjorie Webster and to accredit it if it were found to qualify, apart from the proprietary exclusion. The case is now being appealed, and we expect a decision from it very shortly. I think that will interest many, many of you, and if I may be forgiven, just one more commercial, you'll find a long article about this case in the summer issue of a journal called The Public Interest. Well, I have overrun my time. I merely wanted to point out some of the optimistic signs for the 1970s. Although the private schools of all kinds are going to continue to be faced with very serious financial problems, I think the 70s offer us a better prospect now for the development of alternatives and options in education than we've had for a long time. Thank you very much.